Choke points. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Chris, would you say, based on what you see on the text line, that people feel the Department of Transportation is unresponsive to their complaints?
Yes, and not just there, but you know, comments at mynorthwest.com when I write these stories. Yeah, it seems like the wheels of bureaucracy seem to run pretty slowly.
And yet sometimes there's a breakthrough.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases, and it's something that should help the drive on westbound 520, because I see the backup every morning. During the height of the commute, sometime between about 7:20 to 8 o'clock, I really start seeing the westbound of 520 bogging down right there at Montlake. Same thing in the afternoon. There are a couple of reasons for that, obviously. The first being that we lose a lane going through that area from three lanes on the bridge to two lanes as you go through Montlake. The other is that the ramp to Montlake actually fills in so heavily, it backs up onto the main line.
It's a heavily traveled ramp. 70 to 75,000 vehicles are coming using 520 every day, and 30% of those are using the Montlake interchange. We've got a choke point there.
The Department of Transportation's Steve Pierce says bus riders sitting in that daily backup there noticed that there was a little extra room on that ramp at Montlake.
Then they're all on their Twitter accounts and they're taking pictures of this, what they think is an empty lane. It's actually a shoulder, but we looked at it and said, hey, we can use this for the next 6 or 7 months and allow buses to use that.
So Pierce says they plan to stripe in a new shoulder lane that buses can use, and they're going to put that in this weekend. It's going to basically be a bus bypass.
It essentially takes the shoulder there. We've got some room. It takes the shoulder and it allows buses, it'll put them onto a shoulder, which will allow them to jump the queue, if you will. It'll probably save them three, maybe four lights, waiting through lights. So that's probably equates to 6 or 7 minutes in a morning commute.
So, of course, drivers probably are not going to like the fact that buses are going to be on their right side and jumping in front of them.
They can just take the bus then.
Well, the other thing is we'll see if the cars let them back in, let them merge in. But it is, of course, state law to yield to a bus who is merging back onto the freeway. So we'll see how that, or on any road. So we'll see how that goes. It's possible the cars will pick up a little extra time as well. Now, Pierre says this is a very little tweak driven by users of the 520 bridge that should help the overall commute.
We listen to our users, the taxpayers that use this road. And more than one person got on their Twitter account and said, hey, how about this? And we went out there and said, you got a point here. Let's utilize every inch of roadway that we can. And that's exactly what we're going to do.
So the Department of Transportation is being a little bit more responsive to its users. Now, this is only a temporary fix. This transit shoulder lane is only going to be around for a couple of months. It's going to go away early next year when the next phase of the 520 project begins, which is the complete design of that entire Montlake interchange. And so we're going to see a whole bunch of moving parts there as we redo that interchange. When construction begins on that, all eastbound drivers of 520 are going to be funneled into the westbound lanes of 520, the new lanes there between Montlake Boulevard and the floating bridge. So that way they can build the new eastbound lanes from Montlake out to connect to the floating bridge. And it's going to stay like that for a couple of years. Think about it. Wow. We still have a decade's worth of work before the entire 520 project will be considered finished.
Because this doesn't even touch the Portage Bay Viaduct then.
No, that's the next phase. So as soon as we get Montlake going towards the end of that, we're going to start building the two new bridges that go across Portage Bay over to I-5. That will include the new, part of that's going to be the new extra express lane, reversible express lane that they're going to build for buses that will take them right into South Lake Union. They're building a new flyover ramp that will join the express lanes.
Really?
Yeah.
That bypasses I-5?
Correct. It's going to go into the express lanes, and it's going to be reversible. So in the afternoon, and for the first couple of years, that's going to be transit only. Eventually, it'll transition to an HOV and transit only once they finish the complete project. So that we've had 10 more years of work to do, but right now, it's all going to be crunched right there through Montlake.
Now, is it true that even with all of that, even with widening the Portage Bay crossing, you're still going to be funneled into one lane on I-5?
Where the ramp joins it. Yeah,
the ramp.
Unless they redo some work there, because there just isn't any room there. So
that's pretty much as big as that interchange is going to get.
Correct. Thanks again to the fact that we have a
geography.
Lakes, hills, lakes.
Got to fill those in.
Yeah, and great ideas of adding people joining onto the freeway onto the left and onto the right. Who built that freeway?
I don't know. It's the story of a man who spent weeks in the Oso debris field searching for his brother, who was on the wrong job at the wrong time on that fateful Saturday in 2014. Cairo Radio and Snohomish County have teamed up to help raise the $6 million needed to help the families of the 43 people killed in the Oso landslide build a memorial park at the site of the disaster. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here with the story.
53-year-old Stephen Hadaway was a former Marine who settled with his wife of more than 30 years in Darrington. He was one of three workmen out working on the home of a 31-year-old nurse who had just bought her first home along Steelhead Drive. Stephen was installing the satellite dish at that home. He had been on the job for about 2 hours and 15 minutes when the slide hit just after 10:30 on March 22, 2014. He was almost done with the job. In Puyallup, Stephen's brother John was enjoying the sunny day when he got a call from a relative asking if he had heard about the slide in Oso. He hadn't. John had never heard of Oso, but he knew his brother lived in Darrington, so he sent him a text.
Lost track of time. A couple hours later, nothing. So I sent him another text. And then I sent my nieces a text. I sent my sister-in-law a text. I sent my other brother a text. And then I finally got a call from my other brother, and he says that we think Steve's in the slide.
John made his way to an Arlington command post and gave officials all of Steven's information. He then drove the long way around to get to his brother's house in Darrington to be with his family the morning after the slide. Then John wasted no time joining up with search crews in the debris field. He needed to find his brother.
It's like a movie set. Nothing registers. Nothing is what you're seeing is believable. It's like your brain can't grab what you're seeing. 5:30 was completely covered. And then the field where the homes were, just 80, 90, 100-foot mounds. And then everything we were walking on, the mud was like wet cement and oatmeal mixed.
You couldn't stand still because it was like quicksand and you'd sink. And even today, John has a hard time describing the horrific scene.
The smell, the taste, it's just hard to describe anything at all. I mean, it was just horrid.
John worked alongside other civilian volunteers and fire crews in that search effort, which he says could not have happened without the local logging community and the heavy equipment they brought in.
I mean, watching them with the excavators, it's like their bucket was God's hands. They were so gentle, and they were going 1 foot at a time and then bring it over and shake it, and the spotters were there. I mean, it was a horrible thing to view, but something amazing that I hope I never see again.
And that level of care was given from everyone involved in this search and recovery, something John will never forget.
When they would blow a horn, that means something or someone was found. So everybody stopped working. There was human remains they found. And they had, it was like a backboard, and it was covered in a tarp. And they were escorting them out like they were the most important person in the world.
That person found on that day had a Popeye tattoo, just like John's brother Stephen did. John had originally been told that it may have been his brother whose remains had been found. It was not, and it would not be the first time that John would get his hopes up that his brother's remains had been found. John spent 7 weeks out in the field with local fire crews and other civilian volunteers searching for his brother. And every time someone was found, he'd wonder if it was Stephen. It wasn't. There were 43 people killed in this slide. John's brother Stephen was the 42nd person to be found, the second to last, 2 months after the slide. John remembers getting the call from a firefighter named Brad like it was yesterday.
He called me 8:10 Friday morning. And he says, he asked me how I was doing. And he says, we got him. He says, we got all of them.
And for John, the memorial is personal, but not just for his own loss.
That's going to honor the 43 people, the community, the search and rescue, the volunteers, everybody involved. It's not about one individual person. There's 43 lives that were affected. So many more people that were left behind. You've got all the firefighters that were out there. I will guarantee you that some of them have some bad dreams. This is hopefully a place that they can go that could give them at least some piece of, you know, I help.
You can get a look at this memorial design and find out how to donate at mynorthwest.com/helpOSO, or you can just text the word OSO to 98973.
And this whole idea began with the survivors, right?
This is the family, the survivors, yeah, the surviving family members came together, and actually some people who survived the slide itself, and they really took great levels of care to get all of those same people in the room and put a little bit of what each of them is important for them in here. And it's really a great memorial design where you can walk through. It's also very important to all of these folks involved that the story of what actually happened be told, and that there is this place for firefighters to come and heal. I've done, in doing this series of stories, I've interviewed at least 3-4 firefighters by now. Not a one of them has not admitted to me that they've got some PTSD from this.
Wow.
So it's a way for them to go and heal. And also to really celebrate that community that came together, like we've talked about a couple of times in these stories, this logging community that came out that first day. They got their equipment out there. They took this great level of care and respect in these search efforts. And it's something that touched all of these lives that everyone wants to be able to share. And John has told me in this story, and I've talked to other people who have told me the same, and I've seen it myself, there is always someone stopped there at those trees that are there right now. People from out of state, people come to see it. The 43 trees there now are not good enough. They want to get this bigger design.
Thank you, Hannah.
You
can text the word OSO to 98973 to get more information about the memorial. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Last time I talked with reporter Shane Bauer, he'd gone undercover in a white militia. This time you got a job at a private prison. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I filled out an application online for the Corrections Corporation of America. Didn't think that they would actually hire me, but I wanted to really get a deep look inside of these for-profit prisons that have really existed since the 1980s that, you know, we haven't really got a really up-close look at them. I sent my application off, and within a couple of weeks, I was getting phone calls for interviews, and I eventually took a job for $9 an hour in Winfield, Louisiana.
What was it you were looking for?
I wanted to see what it's like to be held and working in a prison that's run at a profit. I wanted to get at all aspects of it, which is why I went to work there instead of using kind of more traditional means of reporting. And what I found is that the profit motive manifested in so many ways in the way the prison was run. There were 25 guards, often for 1,500 inmates. Medical care was abysmal. I met a prisoner who lost his legs and fingers to gangrene after begging to be sent to a hospital for months. And this dynamic was really common. By contract, the company they sent a prisoner to a hospital would have to foot the bill. So they're reluctant to do so. They cut programs. The guards who were paid $9 an hour were often selling contraband to prisoners to make ends meet. It was just an all-out chaotic environment that was really run in a kind of bare bones way. And this even manifested in the way that we were trained. I was told on my second day of training, an instructor asked us what we thought we should do if we see two inmates fighting. I think anybody imagines that the job of a prison guard is to break up fights between prisoners. And he said that we were not to get in the middle of them. We were simply to shout at them, stop fighting. In doing so, we fulfill our legal obligation. And he said, you know, don't get in the middle of them. We are not going to pay you that much. And our job, what's important is that we go home at the end of the day. And he said, if those fools want to cut each other, then happy cutting.
Really? You quote one of the officers as saying, can't whoop people's ass like we used to. So what was the relationship between the guards and the prisoners?
You know, it varied. I often saw guards and prisoners kind of bonding over their shared disdain for the company. Guards also felt exploited by the company. But ultimately, the environment was so toxic, and there was a kind of this daily sense that things were just barely being held together. And, you know, one of the things that really surprised me about this experience was how much and how quickly I changed myself being in that position.
You changed yourself. What does that mean?
When I went in, I thought I'll just be, you know, easygoing guard, treat people humanely, and I won't have trouble. But I saw that it was not that simple, that I would be put in a position where I'm having to kind of manage these problems that really come from a kind of high level management, but manifest in the kind of day-to-day life that I'm dealing with, I'd find myself feeling guilty some of the times for my role, for punishing people. And I very quickly learned that if I was going to continue that job, I had to turn that part of myself off.
So let me get this straight. You went in thinking you would be sort of the model prison guard. You would be the
right.
the good guy, the humane prison right. guard. But that does not work in prison.
Yeah, I became very authoritarian and really... after just a month or two, felt like the person I was inside the prison was very different than the person I was outside.
So your recommendation, based on having worked as a guard at a private prison, should they be shut down? Is there some fundamental flaw in the way we're running a prison system?
Private prisons should absolutely be shut down. And I don't think that is really such a controversial point. In fact, the federal government, the end of the Obama administration announced that they would not continue using private prisons, although the Trump administration reversed that decision. But the problem is really much larger than that. The fact is that we have such a huge prison system that, you know, private prisons are really a symptom of that. We have so many people in prison that it is impossible to have genuine efforts at, rehabilitation, humane conditions, when we are pumping so many people into the prison system.
Mm-hmm. But we want people to be afraid of going to prison, don't we? That's part of the deterrent effect.
I mean, I don't think that anybody is going to not be afraid of losing their freedom. That does not mean that we need to have prisons be these places where people are just caged and are subject to, you know, extreme violence by other prisoners and sometimes guards. The whole idea of the penitentiary, the history of the penitentiary, is that these are supposed to be places where people are rehabilitated. That is the claim of the penitentiary. And that claim really has no connection to the reality of what prisons are today.
Did you find yourself ever tempted to use violence? Could you feel the anger rising inside you on occasion?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I never used violence on prisoners, but I did explode a number of times. I even, I sent prisoners to isolation after having spent 4 months in solitary confinement myself. And, you know, this is something I still today feel ashamed of. Solitary confinement is a form of torture. The United Nations says this. But when I'm in a position where I'm in a system where there is no other option and somebody is threatening my safety, I'm, of course, going to, do what I can to be safe. And so much of that job was just about really my own ability to get through the day. No part of my duties had anything to do with trying to get people back on track in their lives.
So a broken system can break the people in it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And not just the prisoners, but the guards too. Yeah. I mean, the guards themselves were just poor people from the town that needed jobs.
American Prison, written by Shane Bauer. Shane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Time for your Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, the Oracle of 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. I guess we should do NHL first, shouldn't we?
Yes, we should.
Mayor is in New York talking to the NHL's executive committee, and this sounds like a slam dunk. What's the hockey equivalent of slam dunk?
I don't know. A slap
probably
shot.
An empty net
free
goal.
Shot.
A slap net. Shot.
Slap shot.
Yeah, penalty shot, but those kind of fail sometimes. Yeah.
It would be an empty net. Empty yeah. netter.
Empty netter.
Yeah. They're going to tap it in.
It's an empty netter.
10-member executive committee. And their recommendation is going to be heeded almost certainly by the Board of Governors when they meet in December. You've got extensive ties between the Seattle Ownership and Development Group and that 10-member committee, starting with the fact that the most powerful member of that, Jeremy Jacobs, he's already got a deal to be the concessionaire at the new arena.
What?
Yeah, we've plied him successfully. We got him in the fold by giving him a contract.
He has a company?
Yes.
Interesting.
He's the Boston Bruins owner. Yeah. So he's lined up as a concessionaire.
Talk about the deep state.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then not only that, but one of the other guys on there, the Tampa Bay Lightning owner. Well, what do you know? Todd Leiwicki worked with him extensively because Leiwicki used to be a CEO of the
Lightning. So this presentation
is
just sort of a pageant.
It's going to be shock and awe. We're going to show them how great we are, and then they're going right. to say, we'd love to sell you a franchise for $500 million.
Where does that money come from?
Well, that comes from the pockets of the owners.
Okay.
Yeah. David Bonderman and Jerry Bruckheimer. Okay. Bruckheimer's going to have to get out there and get cracking. Let's get another Transformers out there.
We had Jerry Bruckheimer in here, remember?
Was that Michael Bay? He's a little guy.
I'm still keeping track of all of the people involved in funding the Key Arena and now the owner of this NHL team, but it sounds like no public money will be required.
For the franchise? No, but they're going to help. We're going to help them finance the remodeled arena, right? No,
so. No,
we're not even. We're just going to give them the land for it.
We're going to have to build the road that gets people there, right. The tunnel.
We'll pay in traffic minutes.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's no problem on Mercer, so I don't see. I don't see any.
No impact to traffic.
Don't see any issues
That's
there.
Right.
Yeah. Should we talk about the wrestling diss at Key Arena last night?
Sure.
The old Key Arena, the WWE, which is World Wrestling Entertainment.
That's correct. They used to be the WWF, but they got sued by the World Wildlife Federation. So now they have to be
World Wrestling Entertainment. One of the wrestlers made a crack about basketball during the taping.
It doesn't make sense, you know. It's like having a basketball team in Seattle.
They booed. And they booed. They do. I thought we were supposed to be nice to visitors.
No, not when they insult that. That's a low blow. That's a low blow to our city. But it's also like letting if the villain comes out and insults you, aren't you giving him what you want? Are you letting the villain win by giving him the booze that he wants? This is quite a long boo, though.
No, the boos go on and on. We only have a minute 46 of the boos, but I guess it goes on for several minutes.
There's another minute left.
That's good. Yeah, I can get behind that. Yeah, let him know. But it's kind of like when the guy comes out and he goes, have you ever used this? Try it. It's called soap. If any of you could read, like...
This is all fake, right?
Speaking of WWE, have you guys watched the Netflix series Glow about the glamorous...
Gorgeous ladies of wrestling. From the 80s?
I must say no. I have not.
It's based on the true story of the women wrestlers and how they got started back in the 80s. It's fascinating. I love it. I have to give it a plug. Just, you know, women.
There we go. Glow. We also found this out. Dave has never flipped anybody off.
That's right.
This comes in the wake of Earl Thomas flying the bird at us. Dave, I want you to flip me off.
I'm not going
to
flip
you off. I want you to see how it feels.
I won't even take a picture and put it on social media.
It's an empowering gesture. Like, I think you're going to be surprised. I think you'll be surprised about how you feel.
Had this been like 1978.
Come on, Dave. Opera stinks. Opera's the worst. Opera's a huge, huge waste of time. I can't believe anyone would do it. Come on, Dave.
No, you got to throw the Gilbert and Sullivan diss at him.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, please,
the
I've already been there.
Do I need to show up and protest that? Because I will, Dave. Come on, Dave. Fly the bird at me.
No, I can't do it, Danny.
Oh,
you're just too nice a guy.
Heart,
Dave, Seattle politics is smooth and seamless, and everybody has the best interest of the city in heart. I'm goading you. It's kind of like when you say Seattle doesn't deserve a basketball team, and then everyone goes, boo. I go, opera stinks, and Dave goes, double barrel bird
That's
at me.
That's what he sounds like in the seats of a stadium, heckling.
You can't goad me. I'm your worst nightmare. Yeah. I'm the umpire who doesn't even hear your heckle.
Well, it does sound like an absolute horror show for me. Isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, you would just, you'd be out there heckling and, you know, a guy like me would just say, what's that?
There's got to be something that would get to you, though.
He's cool.
It's like they're right there on the nerve of it.
It'll happen.
Yeah.
It'll happen eventually, but when you least expect it.
I've never seen him angry.
And when your back is turned.
Never?
In the years I've worked, never seen him
What's
angry.
That like?
Because that's why I leave right after the show.
So you can take all of your anger out.
What's that like not getting angry? Because there's not a day that goes by that I don't get angry
at
something.
I realize that. That's why we have you in here, because it helps it's part of your treatment.
Yes, it is. So come on, Dave.
Our Sports Insider is brought to you by...
Maybe just a little flip-off?
Your Western Washington Toyota dealers.
Just a little one?
Car buying is a peaceful bird-free experience.
What if I made the goat sound?
Yeah, that would do it. You know, now I'm getting close. I'm just going to take one of those stun rods and use them.
A taser?
Yeah, a little taser. No, a cattle prod.
Cattle prod?
He turns to violence.
Wouldn't it be easier just to flip me off?
And this was about an hour ago in Washington, D.C.
One thing for sure, the Senate will vote on Judge Kavanaugh here on this floor this week.
That floor being the floor of the U.S. Senate, the voice being that of the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is confident the FBI inquiry into Judge Brett Kavanaugh is not going to change any votes. Let's go to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold, who joins us live each Tuesday from the Washington Post. First, since I haven't checked in about 10 minutes, there have been no new witnesses of any kind to come forward this morning that we know of?
No, there's been some reporting about who the FBI has talked to, and they seem to be the people you would expect, the people that had been named as witnesses or friends of Kavanaugh or Ford during that period. But we don't really know what they've said, and certainly we haven't seen any indication that they've turned up new corroborating evidence.
And I'm a little unclear as to the permissible scope of the investigation. The president has been saying everything's fine with me. He's happy with everything that the Senate wants, but are there boundaries? For example, are they looking into the reports of how many beers it takes a 5'10" man to black out, stuff like that? Or is this strictly related to the alleged sex assault?
From what we can tell, it seemed like it was a bit limited in the beginning. But yesterday, it seems like thanks to pressure from Senators Flake and Collins and Murkowski, the people, the sort of undecided senators, they've said the FBI can pursue these allegations sort of wherever their inquiry leads them. That said, I think you're right. This is the right way to go. They're trying to investigate the allegations of misconduct by Kavanaugh, and I think investigate whether he's lied about anything material to Congress. Things like, you know, did he ever black out drunk? Was he ever drunk in his life? I don't think they're looking at that. And I think they're excluding the Michael Avenatti accuser. There was a woman who came forward last week with an affidavit describing some really terrible events that she thought that Judge and Kavanaugh might have been present for, but she wasn't sure if Kavanaugh had been a part of these sexual assaults. I don't think that they're talking to her or investigating that.
Right. And now she has an ex-boyfriend who's come forward saying, don't believe her because of the way she treated me. So this is, you know, finally going to morph until it includes half the population. So let's talk about your story, which has kind of been eclipsed by this, but there was a court decision which allows the emolument case to go forward. So explain the status. First of all, let's go back over quickly what emoluments are and the status of the case.
Well, Dave, back in the 1700s, the founding fathers of the U.S., said that in the Constitution that presidents can't take what they called emoluments from foreign governments. Now, nobody really knows what this means in the modern context because no president has ever tiptoed over the line. President Trump has gone right up to the line and maybe over it by having his business do business with foreign governments, renting out ballrooms to foreign embassies in D.C., letting foreign leaders pay him to stay at the Trump Hotel when they're visiting. So there's two big suits going on about this. One was filed by the D.C. and Maryland attorneys general. That one has already had some success in court and is getting close to the discovery phase where those two attorneys general could basically demand from Trump's company a list of his foreign government customers, which, frankly, I think they didn't expect to get. That would be a big victory for them, even if it doesn't go further than that. This is a separate case filed by a bunch of Democrats in Congress who said, you know, normally you can't, if you're a member of Congress and you don't get what you want in Congress, you can't use the courts as a plan B and just sue the president, you know, get the courts to do what Congress won't. But in this case, they say, look, President Trump is supposed to, under the Constitution, come to us and ask our permission before he takes foreign emoluments. He hasn't asked us anything. So he's sort of nullified our power. He's nullified our votes by not giving us a chance to vote. Mm-hmm. And so the judge says, okay, this is an unusual situation, but in this case, I'll let members of Congress have standing to sue the president in the courts. So that case is a little behind the other one, but it could produce some interesting results.
All right. So once this case starts going forward, what kind of evidence are the attorneys allowed to gather?
So the attorney general has been limited to just the Trump Hotel in D.C. So as I understand it, they would cause the Trump Organization or its vendors to produce information about any time that a foreign government paid for something at the Trump Hotel, paid for an overnight stay, paid for a group, paid for a ballroom. As I understand it, that's the thing that they're after. We have some press reports about which foreign governments have paid Trump through that hotel. Uh-huh. But we don't have anything from the Trump org, and they would be able to get that sort of official figures.
All right. Well, what about the other suit then?
it's really unclear. That's a much more global lawsuit. So they're not just focused on the D.C. hotel. They're focused on hotels, golf courses, Mar-a-Lago, Trump's businesses. What I'm getting at is,
do you see any situation in which they could demand his tax returns?
Sure. I think that in both cases, they'd like to do that. I don't know if the judge would let them. It's not exactly material, I don't think. Or, you know, you'd have to make an argument about why it was material, but it could certainly happen. Both these things are slow-moving processes. They're federal courts, which take forever to decide anything. And so even though they've been encouraging for the plaintiffs, they're still slow-moving. If the Democrats take one or both houses of Congress in November, I think we'll get a lot of this information much faster through congressional investigations than we would through the courts.
Why doesn't the president just go to Congress, which is controlled by Republicans, and ask for permission to accept the monuments? Because that's what the Constitution says.
It's a great question. And I always wondered why in the first days of his administration, when he was riding so high, had so much goodwill in the Republican Congress, he didn't just go to them and say, look, I don't think these things I'm doing count as emoluments under the Founding Fathers' definition. They're just business transactions. But anyway, just out of abundance of caution, I'm telling you about them, and you tell me if you think they're wrong. And of course, the Republican Congress would have done nothing, or they would have passed a vote saying, this is fine, go ahead. And then all these lawsuits get swept off the table. You know, that would be a shield for Trump from all of this.
Yeah.
But either they didn't think they needed to, or they just didn't think of it.
Well, I suppose, I don't know. I mean, do you suppose the reason is that the members of Congress before passing, I guess would take a resolution of some kind, right? That they would say, okay, just show us where you get your money, and then we'll give our blessing to it.
No, there's no way they would have done that. I don't think they would do it now, and they certainly wouldn't have done it in the beginning of 2017. Republican Congress would have said, you know, you've told us you're going to put these assets in a trust. You're not going to be running your business while you're in office. Everybody and the Republican side seem very satisfied with that arrangement. I think there's no way they would have asked for more documentation before saying yes, or even just doing nothing. If Congress didn't act, but Trump had asked them for their opinion, that would be something.
Well, that seems like a sensible solution. You should tweet at him, because I think that's...
You know, they don't listen to me as much as they used to.
We got to take these things off the table, because frankly, you know, like he said, we'd be tired of winning. I'm tired of winning. The cornucopia of news stories means I only get like 4 hours of sleep a night, which I realize is fine for him, but for the rest of us, it's killing us. I know. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Washington Post reporter David Farenthold.